This is Radio Free Aslan, broadcasting from occupied territory.
This podcast is a joint production between the Chicano Development Center and Great Issues. Today, our discussion is titled Reclaiming Aslan, a history of organizing Brown Berets in Michigan and Texas. We have with us today Jorge Lopez, Jose Villarreal, Nora Salas, Ruthie Verdeen, Sarah Vitale, and myself, Ernesto Morales. Mr. Lopez, could you start us off today by telling us a little bit about the history of organizing Brown Berets and the Chicano movements in South Texas?
I started working with UFW organizer Cesar Chavez, and then we would organize strikes, pickets, you know, at stores that would buy non-union lettuce or non-union grapes. That's how I got started. And we had to go, we were just migrant, we were seasonal workers. So we would leave in right after schooling, and we would come back at the beginning of school, or sometimes we stayed a whole semester and come back by December. And but that's the way it went on. But I was lucky to, at the same time that the United Farm Workers were organizing, Brown Berets out of East Los Angeles were also organizing. They started right after the Black Panther Party, almost simultaneously. The whole movement, Chicano Black movement, everything got started in California. The National Brown Beret Organization, I saw them for the first time at in action. I was in California, I was helping the farm workers, and I went to visit a friend in Fresno, California, and that's when I first caught a glimpse of what a Brown Beret was. And since I knew already some about, you know, the United Farm Workers, and I was already active with Mayo before the farm workers, I was active in Mayo in my hometown during the school walkouts. I was also active with, that's when I became active with La Raza Unida Party also, which was started also in 1970. We were trying to elect a governor, the first Chicano government in the United States. His name was Ramsey Muñiz. We were working around, you know, with him, trying to get him elected. And then in 1971, the Caravana La Reconquista arrived in McAllen, my hometown. It's La Caravana de La Reconquista made up of 24 Brown Berets. It was 22 men and two women. The two women carried the flags. And all 24 of them marched in McAllen against police brutality. So we joined up with them in 1971. And from that day on, they gave us authorization to organize a McAllen chapter. And La Causa meant La Causa de Aslan, you know, trying to get struggling to get our land back, which was swindled, stolen by war, violence, and just not honoring the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, where we were supposed to keep the land and continue to be property owners, but they drove us from the land. You know, Texas Rangers, there was a lot of atrocities committed against Mexican Americans, farm owners of the land. They took the land they came and introduced the tax system, and most of the people lost their lands because of they couldn't pay the taxes. So that was our patch. I mean, we organized the first statewide conference of the Brown Berets in McAllen, because La Caravana had been had already been in Dallas, they had been in San Antonio, they had been in Houston, they had been in El Paso, and Dallas and Fort Worth, and Austin. So we were able to have the first conference. That was in 1972. The first statewide conference was held in the Rio Grande Valley, and that's when we found out that there was more Brown Berets across the state. It was not only us. So we had a big powerful militant Chicano organization, and our focus was on protesting against police brutality. A lot of Chicanos were dying at the hands of law enforcement, Texas police, all departments. So protest was in Austin, at the capital of Texas, was in 1972 when they killed Santos Rodriguez, this officer, white officer, playing Russian roulette with a 12-year-old boy that he caught him in a burglary, but he was trying to get the name from another, you know, co-defendant or whatever, a fall guy. And he was playing Russian roulette when he had one bullet in the 357 Magnum, and the kid didn't know. Anyway, what ended up is that the trigger-happy cop blew Santo Rodriguez's brains out. He was 12 years old. So we were able to get together in the statewide, since we had already been organized statewide. We were able to get about 500 bomb berets on that to protest at the state capitol. That's when we made the first big move statewide, and it was because of the death of 12-year-old Santo Rodriguez from Dallas, Texas. Santos Adán Hernández from the Valley, because he was hanged in Houston, and José Campo Torres in Houston also. I mean, we had a lot of cases. We were going to these towns to march, to protest, and we were mobilizing the community around that issue, and the people were responding. They were responding. From 1970 to 1982, we were very active. Our headquarters was in the Valley, so we were in the Valley when this young girl and her family came to us. They came to us asking for justice. Anyway, they wanted justice. They wanted us to find out the truth about the hanging, because the police department was saying that he had hanged himself. But they say, how the hell is he going to hang himself just for a simple DWI? He was arrested on a DW charge. I mean, I don't think any person in his right mind is going to try to commit suicide or DWI. So the family didn't believe that. So we went and we organized an armed demonstration. We got the permits. I mean, we didn't do this just because, we weren't breaking any laws. So we went and asked for a permit to march with arms in Houston, and they gave us a permit. But all of us were arrested. Except I wasn't arrested, but everybody else was, because I was doing teatro. So we opened up the investigation, and nobody got convicted. But the Santo Rodriguez case, cop did get convicted, but he only got 5 years in prison, 5 years, and he was out in a year and a half. And then the people, the police officer in the Houston deal, they got convicted, and they got 5 years in prison. But we did it. We also organized. We marched everywhere, just about in every major city in Texas. We marched. Every city had a case of police brutality.
What I was hoping that we might be able to do too is because we also have with us Jose Villarreal, who was with Jorge Lopez during this time as a member of the Brown Berets. And I was hoping that he could give us a little bit more information from his own perspective about what was going on at the time. I mean, obviously, very emotional, times. I mean, people are being killed and there's no justice involved and for the community. So maybe if you could talk to us a little bit about that, Jose.
The issue was that the middle class organizations in Texas were not getting involved with addressing the issues of police brutality. So it came down to the hands of the Brown Berets. So the Brown Berets took the initiative to address the issue of police brutality that wasn't being addressed by LULAC and the GI Forum and other middle class Mexican American organizations. And it was very dynamic to see the impact of a small, dedicated, hardcore group of Brown Berets and the impact that they made on the media and on the barrios people, to see the impact, because a lot of times the marches would start with a minimum of the organizers, 10 or 15 people, and then, by the time the march, by the time we got to the police station, we had a following of, 1,000, 2,000 people, maybe more, I don't remember, depending on the city, but the initial organizers were a core group of dedicated Brown Berets. And it should be a lesson to future organizers for future organizing activities that even if it's a small, dedicated, hardcore, militant group can create change, but it's a matter of, just being out there and not being afraid to take to the streets, because I think to a certain extent, the Brown Berets still believe that the power of the people is in the street. And whenever something needs to be resolved, you need to take it to the street. And this is what we did. We took the police brutality issues to the street.
So, Jose, I see from the pictures that you and Jorge have that your guys' chapters was very much involved in, maybe not in the use of firearms, but certainly the symbolic use of firearms. I mean, how do either one of you, I mean, how do you see that? You know, I mean, obviously it was important and you thought it was sending, you know, a message. I mean, what was the message that you thought that it was sending?
We only had two armed demonstrations. You know, we were active, like I say, since 1970 to 1982 in 12 years. I mean, because we weren't making any changes, you know, in police brutality. The police were still brutal. They were still killing people in the street for no good reasons because they took out a shiny object, which was a nail clipper or something, you know, or if you had an attitude like, you know, like a proud attitude, a self-defense attitude, you know, they would, some of these racist cops, you know, white racist cops would take advantage of the situation and blow you and kill you, shoot you. So it was getting pretty, we were getting pretty fed up, okay, with the situation that the police didn't more or less they weren't listening to us, or they didn't really give a damn one way or another, and didn't what we were doing. And they were going to continue to do what they were doing, just be guardians of the rich and protect the rich and the middle class, which pays, you know, most of the cops come from the middle class, also working class. But we were relentless. We were not going to give up, you know. So we decided we were going to have an armed demonstration. When this family came to us, you know, we felt good because, you know, they had come to us to ask us for justice. But you know that justice is a principle. It's not a, you know, this laws is laws. It's a courts of law. There's not courts of justice, you know. Justice is a spiritual principle, you know. But anyway, we were going to do what we could, right? We were going to launch, you know, bring it up to, you know, publicize it and make the community aware of Alan Hernandez and to not to investigate every death, you know, every death the institution of police commits, you know, make sure, okay, it's not just an act of violence or an act of racism, you know. Of course, you know, people get killed anyway, but, you know, because they confront police with armed and dangerous, but they need to, that's sad, but that's what's happening right now.
So, Nora Salas, one of our other panelists, has a question for you guys.
So, there's a recent book about the Chicano movement, because there's been some histories written about it. It's called Raza Si Guerra No. It's by a woman, she's a historian named Lorena Oropesa. And in this book, she talks a lot about the Chicano moratorium in Los Angeles. And she says that after the moratorium, a lot of people in the movement turned to confronting the issue of police brutality. And that issue was much harder to deal with than some of the previous things that people had worked on, like in the 60s, in terms of opposition to the war in Vietnam or the farm workers, other things. And so I'm wondering, and she also says that the state was much more, came down on people much harder for opposing police brutality than they had for opposing the war or for advocating for farm workers or bilingual education or other things that the Chicano movement did. What do you guys think? And she also says that's one of the things that contributed to the end of the Chicano movement, because they moved to the issue of police brutality and it was much more difficult to organize people around and to get the state to not oppose it so much. So do you think the issue of police brutality has special problems that go along with it, if that's the issue your group is going to work on, you know, from your experience? And what do you think about, you know, histories of the Chicano movement that say, you know, it was over by 1971, by 1975, which a lot of them do?
Well, you know, police brutality still exists. I mean, we didn't get rid of police brutality. I mean, but now the situation, the environment has changed. Like, I'm from the Valley. I'm from South Texas. I'm right next to Mexico. We're borderline. We share the border with Mexico. We're real close proximity. You know that the cartel war is going over there. There's billions and billions of dollars in the drug trade. That's why we got two major drug cartels killing each other off, and the government's in the middle, you know, just picking them up, arresting them. And what happened in the valley, what happened in Texas and across the nation is because a lot of drugs, a lot of the, well, it comes from prisons also. Like there's a lot of criminal syndicates in prison. You know, they happen to be Chicano also. You know, they're led by Chicano. And they live in the valley, but you know whatever drove them to that trade was really poverty, because we continue to be the poorest counties in the United States of America. So you know, poverty, lack of education. I mean, then it forces a lot of Chicanos, unfortunately, you know, to get into the drug trade. And so right now, that what's happening in Mexico, all the violence, and it's spilling over into Texas soil, because these groups, which are labeled hate groups, are, you know, unfortunately, like as I said, Chicanos are also, but they have no other solution. So what we are doing now at this stage, no, the movement never ended. It's the activities, maybe the media and all that, the movement continued, but it was on a more like a low scale, or you know, hush hush, behind the scenes. You know, it wasn't a secret society, but we were educating people at one-to-one level, because what happened in 1982 or during this like the march we had in his town, Robstown, Texas. We organized a big march from the community. We marched. We were at street level, talking to the people, and bring them explaining what the issue was, you know, what was happening. The people would respond, and then as he was saying, this Mexican American organization, such as LULEC, GF Forum, they would get in front. The affluent, you know, we have affluent Mexican Americans that are rich, you know, over there in the valley. We all own a piece. Most of us own a piece of the land. We have neighborhoods that belong to us. And I notice over here, you know, as farther north you go, Chicanos are renting.
Chicano movement, I never saw that ending. There was pockets of resistance. I think we've talked about that, especially in the valley and in my hometown. We try to keep the ideology of Chicano movement going. Whether the issue of police brutality became a more difficult issue to deal with, yes. The repression came down, people were arrested. Carnal here went to prison, I went to prison. Ramsey Muñiz went to prison, there was a lot of other berets that went to prison. But the repression did come down. The thing is, wherever that we were at, the organizing continued, whether it was inside the walls or outside the walls, the organizing continued. As far as the message that I think that when I was involved during this message, as far as an armed demonstration, I think that it was sending a message that our pueblo should use any means necessary to defend themselves. And we made it a point to instill in the barrio that everyone should have a weapon to defend their home, whether it's against a criminal that's invading your home, or whether it's for self-protection. But that.
So, all right, I think at this point it's probably a good juncture to kind of jump forward a couple of decades. And what we're going to do is we're going to shift gears a little bit, and we're going to have Nora Salas talk. Nora was a member of the Detroit chapter of the Brown Berets d'Aslan. And so she's going to talk a little bit about that. Particularly, I think, maybe some of the things that were going on in Detroit in the middle and late 90s.
Thank you. Well, like Ernesto said, my name is Nora Salas. I'm originally from Lansing, Michigan. And from 1993 to 1997, I was a student at the University of Michigan, where I got really involved in some Latino student organizations. But over time, the politics of these organizations became less and less appealing to me. And, you know, I was part of a group of people who were working, doing support for the United Farm Workers, first in their campaign against pesticides in the fields, and then later when they tried to organize the strawberry workers centered around Watsonville, California. through that, I met other students at other colleges and also community people, and I got associated with a Brown Beret chapter that existed in Lansing, Michigan, that I believe they started organizing around the issue of police brutality and some killings that had been done of Chicano and African-American young men in the city of Lansing. After I left the university, I moved to Detroit, where I lived for 5 years. And for the first part of that, I moved there pretty much to help with starting the Brown Beret chapter in Detroit. For a time, I was the Minister of Finance, which the finances were pretty small. But we did, it was very affordable to rent a street-level spot, and we had a large street-level center there called the Chicano Development Center at the time to try to reach out to people in the barrio on the corner of Verner and 25th in southwest Detroit. We also worked on issues of police brutality in Detroit. Fortunately, we didn't have cases that we worked on that involved the death of Chicanos. We had some police abuse that had happened, and there was an active movement in Detroit by a lot of African-American organizations against deaths that had happened with that group. The other main issue that I actually participated more in was the issue of immigration reform and people who were new immigrants to Detroit. That group was really taking off in the late 90s. Revitalizing Southwest Detroit, bringing new people and energy into a city that is and was very depopulated from its population height. I think that we were not as prepared to deal with trying to help organize immigrants as we were with the other main group that we worked with. So we worked with two main groups, people who just arrived in Detroit, mostly straight from Mexico, and people who, young men and women who were either gang affiliated or were maybe close to being gang affiliated or were trying to not be gang affiliated anymore, and their interactions with the police. One of the things I really wanted to talk about most, and it's an event that still, it still affects me in the work that I do today, is that we used to do a lot of educational forums because, you want to start something called the Chicano Development Center, but two-thirds of people are really not sure who Chicanos are or what this whole idea is about, and they don't know, maybe they have their own family stories about our history, but it's not united together in one sort of cohesive story of the situation for Chicanos in the United States. So one of the things that we did is we started doing these educational workshops. We would show movies or have speakers, different things in the barrio to try to bring some of the knowledge we learned at the university into that setting where a lot of people never have a chance to really get beyond high school and find out some of the things that we had had access to. Through that, some young women contacted me one time. I had really mixed feelings about this event. They were all the contestants for the Miss Mexico Fiesta, which happened every year in the summer in Detroit down Hart Plaza. It was run by the Mexican Patriotic Committee. It had been happening for 40 years or so. And every year, as part of this project, they were supposed to, they had a talent part. Fortunately, they did not have a swimsuit part, which if they had, might have been a more problem for me personally. But they had also a part where they were supposed to dress up as a woman from Mexican history and portray her, and talk about what she had done as part of pride in our culture. And so like maybe an Adelita from the Mexican Revolution, something like that. But the problem was, and why these women came to me, is they wanted to know if I could do some kind of presentation for them, because every year there was a problem with this part of the contest because nobody could think of any famous Mexican women to portray. So their options that they were dealing with when they came to meet with me was either a woman from the Mexican Revolution that they had an idea of from a mural that they had seen, but they didn't really know anything about what women did and or didn't do in the revolution. Or their other idea was Selena, who is a fine singer, but you know, maybe we should be dealing with some more options for, it's kind of a role model issue that, you know, who are these people's role models and what kind of politics did they help foster in them? So they wanted me to do this. I had kind of mixed feelings about the whole idea of helping out with a beauty pageant because I do and did consider myself a feminist, but I also had, you know, 10 young Chicanas who wanted to know about their history. So we did a series of workshops, and actually it was very, then we didn't really have, the internet wasn't super developed at that time. Also at the XCC in Detroit, we didn't have a lot of funds, so we only had a dial-up connection. So it was really slow. You know, we pulled together some stuff, but it was actually quite difficult. And one of the young ladies wanted to know, you know, well, what about people from Michigan? You know, because I want to, because they're all kind of competing, so they're looking for an angle, right? So they want to know, what about a woman from Michigan, like from the Chicano movement or something? I was like, I don't really know what to tell you, because I didn't know. And that's one of the reasons why this event is one of the motivations behind the fact that now I'm a graduate student at Michigan State University, and my research is about Chicanas and the Chicano movement. I think this story points to an important issue that we did face in the Braves in Detroit, which was the participation of women. There was probably about a third of our members were women. And we often did have people have the perception that women had not been members of the Braves in the past. Like, people were often in the community surprised that we were members of the Braves. Now I know even more that that wasn't the case, that, you know, women's participation varied in different places, but that definitely during the 60s and 70s there were women in the Brown Berets. One of the issues that I think is most salient for, you know, whether or not the movement, which was our Chicano organization, the Brown Berets, which was a nationalist organization, you know, a lot of people have questioned since then whether a nationalist organization can encompass women and feminism. There's been quite a few scholars of the Chicano movement who have questioned this, and I think that there's a lot of different kinds of nationalism, and certainly it can encompass it, but you have to be willing to meet the community where they are. So these girls, they were where they were, was that they were contestants in the Miss Mexico pageant. And through our work with them, you know, I hope to sort of move them along to think of more different options for what their role could be in the community than Selena, or a sort of really cloudy version of the Mexican Revolution. But that's where they were. You know, we also had guys come in sometimes, you know, saying crazy things about fights they had with their girlfriends, different things that I found objectionable as a feminist, but the other side of that is that that was where they were. Maybe they had not had, you know, somebody try to counter some of their ideas about women and about the values that should be placed upon women and men in an organization or in society. And so you can't expect, if you're going to have an organization that has a radical political vision, which ours did, I mean, you can't expect people to come to your organization with a radical political vision, because everything about our society engenders a status quo political vision that just sort of goes along with the United States how it is. So I think that this was where theories of feminism and theories of nationalism sort of hit a hard reality in this situation. I don't think that as women we ever, myself and the other women, ever sort of just let people in the organization do whatever they want, or didn't contest things that we found against women, or sort of trying to make smaller roles for women in the movement. We always contested it, but we always, like many women in the first Chicano movement, which I've learned since then, we also remained part of the organization. We wanted to be in the organization on our own terms. So I think.
So Nora, the Chicano Development Center, on the first sign that was hanging on the building, said that it was a project of the Brown Berets de Aztlán. And so, I mean, since then, that part of it has kind of has kind of been removed. How do you see that? You know, that I mean, we have this project with Brown Berets, you know, we call it the Chicano Development Center, but that it continues. I mean, things are fundamentally the same. The ideology is the same. The mission statement's the same, but we don't really use the Brown Beret. So how do you see that as the evolution of the organization itself? Do you see it as like a step backwards? You know, I mean, how do you think about that in terms of politicization?
I guess that I think that it takes a certain type of person and a certain type of time in a person's life to be involved in the Brown Berets, because one of the things that I think probably was true, and these guys can talk about if they want, 60s, 70s, and was definitely true in the 90s, was that putting on a Brown Beret instantly made you a target at any sort of mass rally or demonstration. You know, people recognized it as a symbol of opposition, recognized that maybe, I'm talking about the police here, recognized that maybe you were one of the people that was involved in creating this disturbance that they did not find desirable. So I think that there's a lot of power in the Brown Beret, symbolic power, power to attract people, power to give people, especially Chicanos, hope, and power for especially for them to imagine and believe that thing a different world is possible. But I also think that there's a lot of risk involved in it. And I don't think that necessarily the people who are involved in it then, for the most part, I don't know necessarily how other people view the changes in their life, but I think for myself, it would be much riskier now for me because of my family situation. I would be taking a much bigger risk than I was taking, for instance, before I had children. And the women who are in and men who are in our organization who had children, you know, now I view their involvement. I did not understand the level of risk that they had taken by being involved with us until I had my own child. So I think that's part of it, is a lifespan part. I don't think that our politics are less radical, but I think that we're doing different things to pursue our politics. I also don't think that any individual person who's pursuing like a radical political project can do take all roles at all times. There's different roles for different people. You know, that said, I have my beret. I know exactly where it is. And there's certain turns of events that certainly could cause me to put it on again. Those things would be, you know, things that I would not want to happen because it would cause a lot of pain and harm to other Chicanos, most likely. But, you know, I don't necessarily think that I've seen the last.
Okay, so thanks, Nora. I think that provides a really good segue into to my next question for Mr. Lopez. Could you tell us then about what you're doing now and the South Texas Freedom Party?
Okay, like I said, you know, we took the Movimiento Chicano, the civil rights movement, and went underground. Well, we didn't go underground, which is because, as you said, we got a lot of heat. A lot of us went to prison, and we were kind of getting tired of going to prison, getting beat up, you know, because we were targets, as you say. And I respect you for your honesty. And I know you have a family. We had a family too, and we, you know, that's part of why we had to slow down, and, you know, we were getting too much heat. I mean, we you know, they had already infiltrated our organization. They had caused a lot of disunity among ourselves, you know what I'm saying? Professional agents, you know, because up to this day, I mean, you know, they created it in the media, a division. They're saying that this Brown Beret's got 15,000 soldiers, and this Brown Beret over here, it got 6,000, and they're in conflict. Who's going to be the supreme leader? It disbanded. I mean, it got messed up. You know, it caused a lot of havoc. And then we did the armed demonstration, trying to bring everything together, and it just didn't work out. They abandoned us. Like right here, like this Ernesto Fraga is from Waco, Pablo's from McAllen, this girl is from Mission, this guy's from Mercedes, I'm from McAllen, this guy's from McAllen, and this guy from Ruffstown, and his wife in the background, there's people from Fort Worth. Those are the only ones he answered. And okay, a lot of people there, that's how it got disbanded. They didn't get disbanded, it just went like, say, you know what, something's going on. We can't continue this way because the government has already infiltrated us and it's taken us somewhere, taking everything. But we never stopped organizing. We never stopped being Brown Berets. You know, I can't find any Brown Berets right now because I got to order them from again. You know what I did? Well, there was one Brown Beret operating in South Texas, which is Pablo. This guy, the one this was our jefe. You know, but he was that's a problem when you got jefes. They want to do it their way. You know, only their way. So we broke up the jefe deal and we formed a committee. This is the committee. It's me, it's Chacon, it's Pablo, it's Fraga, it's Joe. And you know, that's the Texas Chicano Civil Rights Movement Committee. We went into a committee. So we still got Brown Berets in the committee. We got Brown Berets in the committee and now we're forming a new party, a third party, a National Freedom Party. You know, just to give opposition to the Tea Party. You know what the Tea Party is doing? Okay, that's the National Freedom Party is going to encompass all the organizations that were involved in the Chicano movement. Not only the Chicano movement, the Civil Rights movement, the Black movement, the Indian movement. It's all inclusive. It's not a racist organization, which the dominant society is going to try to label us as racist, because when we had La Raza Unida Party, they would always be talking against us because it said raza. It means racist, the united race. But it doesn't mean the united race. In English, yes, it does. But in Spanish, la raza is the people. But when you translate la raza to English, it says the race, the united race. So, you know, they had enough ammunition to be intended banging at the minds of people that, you know, that were hearing the media and the newspaper and the television. They were having a heyday with us. And then the governor got busted with 500 pounds of marijuana and there went the partido lost its credibility, okay? You already beat me up, you already put me in prison, and now you're trying to still, you know, stigmatize me. You know, it's not gonna work anymore. We're gonna go forward. Okay, I decided to bring the people back together again. Okay, In my mind, I said it's time for us to move, to raise the flag again, okay? And that's why we organized the South Texas Freedom Party, okay? The South Texas Freedom Party is asking for political power. Yes, we're gonna run more, elect more legislatures or more state representatives at the local, state, and national level, federal representatives. But now it's the Rick Perry, the governor, has been talking about independent state. The state of Texas is a republic. But we think he's crazy, and the Tea Party, you know, they're making a big a movement against Barack Obama. Really, they don't want the policies of Barack Obama anymore. Okay, they want him out of office. They're trying to burn him. They're trying to do a lot of mudslinging, just discredit him, because they don't want to pay their taxes. The Tea Party, they're rich. Of course, they lose a lot of millions in taxes. But you know, that's why they're crying, because of the taxes, because now they're being taxed the way they should be taxed. So they're making a big deal out of it, you know, trying to get discredited Barack Obama, you know. And Barack Obama has been good for the people. I mean, of course, he hasn't done much yet on the immigration reform, but I'm sure he'll get to it sooner or later. But I don't know how which way it's going to go. But our position is if they're going to be legalized or pardoned or amnesty or whatever, and they should return our identities back to us and come into the country under their name, because there's a lot of Chicanos, Mexican-Americans, and Mexicans that have lost a lot of immigrants are using our identification. They have stolen our identities.
So last night when we were talking, you were telling me a little bit about the Jacinto Treviño College and kind of some of the things that are going on with that. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Okay, the South Texas Freedom Party, we're calling for a new state. The state of Texas has 190 million acres of land. We're asking for a South Texas state, legal state, which we can do with the consent of the Texas legislature. If we are able to get the consent of the Texas legislature, that's why we need a national party, which is the National Freedom Party, because we also need the consent of the U.S. Congress. But it's through consent, entiendes? All the right way, the legal way. We're not going to be marching with guns, and we're not going to be. Those two marches, because we were fed up. I mean, they had killed a demonstrator in FAR, Texas, and they had killed and they had hanged a human being from the valley, from our side of town. Both of them were killed by police. And we were Brown Berets. I mean, we had to do something. I mean, we're against police brutality, and they're not listening to us. Well, we just got a little more. So we just wanted to send a stronger message. The Colegio Jacinto Treviño is the Colegio Jacinto Treviño is the first Mexican American university in the United States. It was established Chicano Mexican American at that time, you know, and that was the first Chicano Colegio was in Mercedes, Texas, and that's where this guy is from. Chacon is from Mercedes, and that's where the Colegio was in Mercedes. So everything was happening at the same time. Colegios. Raza Unida Party, Mayo, Brown Berets, UFW, United Farm Workers. Everything was happening at the same time. Okay, it was like an American Revolution in the 60s. Trying social changes. The Black Panther were also added, and you know, everybody was the American Indian Movement. You know, the Wounded Knee. I mean, we were everywhere. But the Colegio Jacinto Treviño was an alternative to the present-day school system, the colegios, you know, and teach our way, our side of the story, our side of history, and research and document all our history. Like you say, like those ladies that they were role models, like they don't know who to choose. Well, the only way they can choose is by teaching them history, their history, and who are the characters. The ones that the dominant characters, the ones that make changes, the people that like Pancho Villa, Emiliano Zapata, Francisco Madero. I mean, there's a lot of women in history, a lot of women that didn't follow the traditional the women in society. I mean, they were outspoken and. Because why? Because they were revolutionary. They had revolutionary ideals. They were women on fire. And the Colegio right now is, we're talking about land swindles. We're running a campaign right now in San Juan, Texas. We bought, the Colegio moved to San Juan. It was 33 acres and about 30 mobile homes. We had $1 million project, but then there was a falling out within the Mesa, the board of directors, some wanted to go communist, some wanted to go national. They were caught up in the ideology, in the theory. And somehow or another, they lost the accreditation and they lost the funding. And we as Brown Berets, we were losing it to the Mexican-American middle class, but we as Brown Berets went and occupied the colegio, the land, and we kicked them out. And it belonged, we got it back. We freed it or whatever. We liberated from the hands of the tío tacos vendidos coconuts. Okay, but that Chicano, you know, they don't even want to acknowledge the existence of a Chicano people. Barely the census barely acknowledge that we exist as a group, which is a Mexican American and Chicano. But the Chicanos has been the one who's always been struggling. He's the one that's been dying. He's the one that's been going to prison. And then he's the one that raises the flag and speaks for the people. He's not afraid. Why? Because we have a legitimate right. Because the Texas Indians were here. When the Spanish colonialism came, they mixed with the Texas. That's how we became Tejanos. We are Tejanos. Yeah, we're Chicanos, Mexican-Americans, and Mexicans, but we are Tejanos from Texas. And we're also U.S. citizens because we're federal citizens also. But right now, we're trying to divide the state of Texas in two. It has 234 counties. We want 117. No, it's got 234 counties. We want 117 for South Texas, 117 counties for North Texas. There's 5 million acres of land, of water. 2,500 for us, 2 million. I mean, you know, it's something to organize around. And it's, North Carolina, South Carolina divided, North Dakota, South Dakota, Memphis, West Memphis. You know, it's already done. It's already been done. But, you know, Texas is the center. It's the heart of the United States. They have a lot of forts and a lot of bases in the military. There's a lot of, it's a strategic area for our strategic area. But, you know, but we're still in that strategic area. Nothing's gonna change. We're still gonna continue to be a state of the union, which is just another star to the flag. But we will be able to set up an independence legislature, which the majority will be Mexican Americans and Chicanos. But at least we'll be in where we can decide law. And then we'll have a separate penal code, a separate, you know, everything separate. Our way of teaching kids, our school system. And I think we're smart enough to develop a school system that will give a higher learning or higher, you know, to our kids. And, you know, right now, like, we're spreading, like, right now we're here in Lansing where we're bringing the party here, you know, for it to originate here in Lansing as the first, you know, chapter or first organ or first locale or whatever of the National Freedom Party. So where we become national, where all the movements get together on a national level, and we try to, we're still helping the state of Texas, but also helping.
So what I'd like to do is I'd like to thank everybody for coming today, but I would like to give everybody one last chance to kind of go around and talk about some different things. We'll start with Jose.
Brother George, Jorge was talking about the planting the seed for the third party concept. It's going to be a revival, maybe of Ex-Raza Unida. It's going to start at the local level. It's a seed. We're planting the seed for the concept of a third party for Chicanos across the United States. And we're interested in people who are willing to share that ideology and work together, and so that maybe this could be a spark to move the Chicano movement forward. These are ideas that are coming. These are ideas that are coming for the future, for get the Chicano movement again in this next phase that's coming up. Also the Colegio Jacinto Treviño, the only Chicano institution, educational institution to ever exist, is also on the revival. Carnales back home, they're trying to get the land back. It was swindled. And from there, we're hoping to attract educators, volunteers, college students, and more importantly, la gente del pueblo, to participate like it used to be, as an alternative, as a popular school. And I think that the Chicano movement can make great strides with this instrument of having the colegio revised, revival, and also planting the seed of a third party alternative. It's something for all of us as activists. All of us have had some experience in organizing. We're not the only ones. We don't claim to be super leaders or anything like that. We humble ourselves before any community that we are only servers of the people. We serve the people, and we stand up for the people in any circumstance. And we're willing to work with anybody. And we will continue to continue our education. All of us here are attending school. And hopefully go back to the community and keep the revolution.
Thank you, Jose. Well, I don't have anything too profound to add. I guess I think that one of the things that oftentimes people think about when they think about this idea, this third party idea that you all are talking about, or dividing Texas into two states, which I think actually sounds like a good idea, because when I heard Rick Perry was calling for the independence of Texas, I said, well, so you can make it independent, but I think the majority of people are going to be Mexicans or African Americans, so I'm not really sure what you think is going to happen after it becomes independent. You're going to establish like a South African apartheid state to keep everybody down so you all can still be in charge, or what? I'm not really sure what the plan is in the heads of people like that. But, you know, other people have plans. Chicanos, people who have a different vision for the United States, should have their own plans. And we should never discount the possibility that the plans that we have and the visions that we have might succeed. A lot of people, when they're doing sort of left politics, radical politics, plan for failure. They plan they're going to show up at the rally and nobody's going to come. What are they going to do? They plan that they're going to have an event, and what happens if nobody comes? People should plan for success, because eventually I think that we will get there, and we need to know and have a plan for how to build upon that. And I wonder, I don't know how close we are to having lost our time. But I wonder, as participants in, because right now I teach a class about the Chicano movement, right? And most of my students don't really know anything about it, regardless of whether they're white students or Chicano students or whatever. And a lot of times they ask me if, I wonder if you all could weigh in on this question. They ask me, or eventually we always get in this discussion of whether or not the Chicano movement is racist or was racist because it advocated for Chicanos. And there's a real thing in phenomena in our society right now that anybody who talks explicitly about race, just bringing up race, is racist. That's the idea that's out there, that we're in a post-racial America, which obviously we're a little skeptical, I think, for the most part about that. I wonder if you guys aren't going to be there with my students when I have to talk to them about whether or not the Chicano movement was racist or not. You talked a little bit about some alliances you had with other groups, like African Americans, the American Indians, maybe some with white people who were left wing. I don't know if you did or not. I wonder if you could talk a little bit, you know, if somebody asked you that from amongst the students of today, you know, what do you think about who the Chicano movement was for and who was involved in it and its sort of relationship to racism or not?
I think everybody has a personal perspective on that. My own personal perspective as being involved in the Chicano movement would be simply that Chicano people were the one that were being trumped up on. The Chicano people were the one that were being stomped on. And the Chicano people were the one who were being killed by the police. So the movement, the resistance against police brutality came from the barrios, came from the families that were asking help. And the Brown Berets were there. The Chicano movement was there to bring this to the attention of our pueblo and in demanding that this injustice is stopped. At some point, I think we all realized as activists that the Brown Berets or any organization cannot do it alone. So we had contacts, you know, in the universities, in the community, with other, you know, liberal people, white liberal people, black activists, who also had the same ideology that we had, and that saw that our cause was just. So as an organization, I think that we matured and we learned from early on that as we couldn't do it alone, that we needed other people. And I think personally, this is where we stand, although the emphasis should be to the defense of the Chicano people. And whoever sees, identifies with that cause, then they're more welcome to join, whether they're black, yellow, green, sexual orientation, whatever. We have to, this is going to take a lot of work. The idea of a third party and the idea of reviving the Chicano movement, I think we need to.
Okay, we're going to let Mr. Lopez have the last word on it.
I'm going to say yes, that there was some racism in the Chicano movimiento. A lot of, you know, because, you know, but it was, there's always been racism, you know. From the very beginning, but the people in the in front or the leaders were not racist. Of course, you know, we had people that were racist, but they were not in a leadership. They didn't play no leadership role. Of course, we had our struggles with those people too, because you know, we didn't come. It's not about racism. It's about change. It's about social change. It's about, hey. We fight their wars. I mean, we go to Vietnam. We've died in Vietnam. We die in the Persian Gulf. We died in Afghanistan. We died in World War One, World War Two. You know, I mean, I think it's not an impossible objective to divide the state of Texas in two. I mean, it's legal, and it's by consent. We're not gonna go. Shoot nobody over it. I mean, we are going to organize and we are going to raise our flag, which is the flag of South Texas. I mean, for 40 years, I mean, we've been struggling. I mean, you know, since 1966, really, right after the Civil Rights Act of 64. I mean, we've been trying to have a governor, Mexican-American governor, a Chicano governor, because we're the majority over there. We're 95%. I mean, it's only natural that we're going to have a Chicano government. It's only natural that the party is probably going to elect a Chicano governor or a Mexican-American governor. But if they elect a Mexican-American government, you know, it's going to be the same thing. There's no change. Only a Chicano can change the way, bringing back our history into the school system.
This monthly podcast is brought to you by the Chicano Development Center, a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to education and political empowerment through grassroots coalition building. We believe in the indigenous sovereignty of the Chicano people in the United States, and that true social and political change begins with the people. Our style of low-intensity organizing endeavors to build intentional communities within greater communities. The motivating force behind low-intensity organizing is to constantly challenge the status quo as to the treatment and economic status, not only of Chicanos and other indigenous people, but of all oppressed people. At the Chicano Development Center, we believe that resistance begins with education, organization, and preparation. We believe that raza must take action on a regular basis, not just in times of crisis.
Love the best.